Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. In 1847, there was a dinner party held at James Simpson's house in Edinburgh, Scotland. Simpson was a doctor. He taught obstetrics, and he loved to have a good time. At this particular dinner party, at least this is how the legend goes, the meal finished, and everybody gathered together, and the doctor showed people a crystal decanter. But what was inside this decanter was not booze. It was a project that James Simpson had been working on for a while. It was chloroform. Simpson's guests were also, apparently, up for fun, up for anything. They tried the stuff. They passed out cold, and they woke up the next morning, of course, still wearing their fancy clothes. In the next few years, chloroform became huge. Queen Victoria used it when she gave birth. Doctors used it for all sorts of operations. Some people consider James Simpson a genius. And there's a theory that groups of geniuses tend to pop up more in environments where they're nurtured and respected, and they're surrounded by people who are willing to entertain their ideas. Eric Weiner thinks Simpson was part of a genius cluster that existed in Edinburgh in the 1800s and that completely changed medicine. So here's the crucial question in a globalizing world. Where are we going to see the next crop of geniuses? And what places that we think of as epicenters of intelligence are going to start to wane? Eric is the author of The Geography of Genius. Thanks for coming in to talk about this.
I am thrilled to be here, Kara.
So when you travel around the world, as you do all the time, what are the places you see as being places where there's a lot of creativity, there's very interesting mixing? We certainly think in the American mind about China and India rising, and maybe you see those or maybe you see other places.
China's a tough one. I have a chapter on China, but it's China in the 13th century, although I travel there in the 21st century. The Chinese bemoan what they call the innovation gap. You know, as many Chinese people told me, everything's made in China, but nothing's invented here. You know, when are we going to have the next Steve Jobs? So I met with someone who people consider the Steve Jobs of China. His name is Jack Ma. He founded Alibaba, which is a huge company, and he's the richest man, well, one of the richest men in the world, certainly. And he thinks that Chinese have to get in touch with their past, get in touch with their spiritual traditions, whether it's Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and that they don't need to look to the West to be creative. In fact, I discovered there is this long tradition of creativity in China. Don't forget, in the 13th century, when Europeans were picking lice out of their hair and wondering when the Middle Ages were ever going to end, the Chinese, you know, were inventing the compass, were creating great art, and the city of Hangzhou, which I visited, was at the time a city of 1 million people, the biggest in the world. So it's possible that China will rediscover that creative spark, I think, if the political system allows it. Otherwise, I look around the world and I see some interesting examples of small nations that might have that special something, such as Estonia. Now, as you may know, Skype was invented in Estonia.
I did not know that.
As you now know,
yeah.
Skype was invented in Estonia.
I have been to Estonia, and it is sort of, it's tiny, but it's this, it's amazing feeling. It's very vibrant, very forward-looking.
Very open.
Yeah.
And it has a strong culture. Unlike other former Soviet republics, the Estonians were never really Russified. You know, other countries like Moldova really had their own culture neutered, I think. But in Estonia, it remained very strong, and it is strong to this day. And they're well-positioned geographically, and they have, as I said, this openness, free flow of information. And it's not a coincidence, I think, that Skype and other high-tech firms got their start there. So it might be some unexpected place like that. I can tell you it's probably not going to be North Korea. And again, it's not because the North Koreans aren't genetically, don't have the genetic wherewithal or don't work hard. It is because they don't have an open system and they don't have a culture that promotes creativity. Because, you know, we just have this myth that you're just born a genius like Mozart, or the 10,000-hour rule. You got to put in the 10,000 hours and then you'll be a genius. And I think that's wrong. I think, you know, you need some genetics, you need some hard work, but you need the right environment or it's not going to happen.
And what are some places that right now we think of as sort of amazing incubators? This could be anywhere from, you know, it could be Paris, it could be London, it could be Silicon Valley, but that you feel like are maybe they've seen their best days, or they're slightly in decline, like they're on the other side.
There's always a lag between when the golden age ends and when the people realize it's ended. You know, it's like you're at a party and 3/4 of the people have left, but you're drinking and you haven't noticed until you look around and say, oh, I guess the party's over. Now, let's talk about Silicon Valley then, because I think in the book, I openly question whether it belongs on the same pedestal with Athens and Florence and some of these other places I investigate in the book. And I'm not sure. I think the jury's out. I think Silicon Valley represents what we value. And what I mean by that is we value technology and convenience and speed, and all these things are embodied in Silicon Valley. We get the geniuses that we want and that we deserve. So in, you know, 18th century Vienna, they valued beautiful music and they got it. They got a Mozart and a Beethoven and a Haydn. What do we value? We value technology. We get a Steve Jobs and a Mark Zuckerberg and a Bill Gates. You know, if we were to fall out of love with our gadgets, would Silicon Valley continue to thrive? I'm not sure. None of these places last very long. Golden ages are a couple decades, maybe a century. And Silicon Valley's had a very good run. And I reckon
that's right. They've been, I'd say, 50 years, 60 years of being what we think of as Silicon Valley, not a bunch of cherry orchards and peach orchards as they used to be.
Yeah. Right. And people have been predicting the demise of Silicon Valley for a long time, and they've been wrong. And I can hear the emails and calls already from people in the Valley saying, you know, we're not dead. We've constantly reinvented ourselves. And that is true. You know, first it was silicon chips, and then, you know, it was the internet and digital mobile technology. But it's still kind of a one-note town. It just plays it in different keys. And these other, a true golden age, like Edinburgh or like Florence, tends to spark in different directions and not just be one industry. Look at Detroit. I mean, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, who would have predicted the demise of Detroit? So my advice to people of Silicon Valley is whatever you do, don't get arrogant, because that leads to complacency.
Well, it also feels like, you know, at a time when, as you say, people value music, the great thinkers are drawn to that particular challenge. Like, you know, if we were in a Wall Street era, as we have been before, where the smartest people in the country, in the world, went to Wall Street, maybe, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates and Larry Page and Sergey Brin, they'd all be on Wall Street doing what they're doing, because there'd be, that's where the rewards would be.
Right. Well, I think it's twofold. One is that, yes, the best and the brightest are attracted to a particular field, whether it's classical music or Wall Street or Silicon Valley, number one. Number two is that genius needs someone to appreciate its genius. So in Vienna in the 18th century, people loved music, ordinary people, not just the emperor, though he too. And so they were almost like co-geniuses. They were validating the genius. And so today, have we heard of Thomas Addis? I hope I'm pronouncing it right. Addes, one of the greatest classical composers of our day. But he's not that well known, not because he's not a great musician. He is, and composer, but because we don't care as much about classical music. So it works for both of these reasons. We get the geniuses we want and we deserve. And right now we want a Steve Jobs, a Mark Zuckerberg, and that's what we get.
It's interesting that our culture, more than a lot of other times and places that have focused on genius, are really focused on what seems to be a very commercial aspect of intelligence. And maybe I'm wrong there, but music or fixing, you know, improving medicine. Yes, of course, there are commercial dimensions so that you can make money doing those things. But Silicon Valley feels particularly commercial and money oriented in terms of like rewarding those particular aspects of genius that we do.
Well, I mean, that's the measure of success. There is a.
But was it always? Was that always the measure of success? Was like Michelangelo looking at his bank account?
No. I mean, Michelangelo didn't particularly care about money. In fact, he lived like a pauper even after he achieved great success. The Medicis, his patrons, cared about money, and so he needed their money. And, you know, you look at the Valley today and the Medicis are really the well, the venture capitalists or the Medicis of the day, let's put it that way. I know there is a kind of almost evangelical spirit in Silicon Valley also. People want to make a lot of money, but they want to change the world. Mm-hmm. Or they want to change the world, but they want to make a lot of money doing it, depending on how you look at it. So I think money alone is a pretty poor motivator. And I think that people are motivated by a sincere desire to improve and change the world, you know, but they also want to get filthy rich while doing it. You know, I wrestled with three words throughout researching this book. You know, one is genius, another is creativity, another is innovation. And they have kind of the same meaning, but different nuances. And, you know, innovation is the buzzword in Silicon Valley. Everyone wants to innovate. But do they want to be creative? That's riskier. Do they want to aim for genius? That's even riskier. Innovation to me sounds like the safe, businessy way of being creative or being a genius. Let's just innovate. Nothing too much, just enough to get really, really rich. But it doesn't work that way. All these golden ages, people took tremendous risks. I mean, in the Renaissance day, I mean, you were risking everything. You were risking fortune and your name and your family's well-being by becoming an artist or embarking on one of these bold ventures. And we're always hedging our bets now and reducing risk. I mean, let's talk about Michelangelo again. He's chosen by Pope Julius II, who was a Medici himself, to paint the Sistine Chapel, the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. But he was not an obvious pick. He was mainly someone who did statues. He didn't, you know, and didn't really do that much painting. And yet the Pope at the time said, I'm going to bet on you. Do we take a chance, or do we just hire people who've shown they can already do that job already? We don't really take risks like they did in the past.
Eric Weiner is the author of The Geography of Genius. Thank you so much
for
coming in.
I hope you're now feeling more creative.
I am. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.